Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
Oh, when he wore.
Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
He washed my sins away.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, on the road, but always in communication with this audience every day and twice on Tuesdays, once at noon, once at 7 o'clock for the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the latest on the role that your genes play with empathy, plus a lot on health and healing. Then two commentaries. I select one day a week to share a form with those who have great commentaries, but not necessarily a form. And the first is from Chris Hedges, the empty place where the American press resides, and from Truth Dig, and also from John Whitehead, Dictator for Life, The Rise of the American Imperial President. Also, I'll be sharing some insights today on the environment, including The Coming Climate Famine Anarchy by Dr. Glenn Berry, and No Hugging, Are We Living Through a Crisis of Touch? By Paula Consaza from The Guardian. And also I have some audio files today to share. The first is I'm going to be doing a series on spiritual feminism. Almost never do these individuals, these women, have a chance to appear in the media. They have been condemned and called terrible names by the hard feminists, the polemics. They see bringing morality, ethics, decency, spiritual concepts into the discussion as meaningless and counterproductive. I do not. The hard feminists have had the forum and total control through the media of the topic for decades. So, isn't it time now that we allow other voices in? I don't believe that you learn more by excluding people who have something that may contribute to the discussion. So we're going to start today. We're going to have two voices, a woman speaking at the UN on the new type of feminism, Emma Watson. She's talking about the future feminism from Factual Feminist. That's another feminist who believes in more spiritual principles and is condemned. And then Jordan Peterson talking about beta males, people with low self-esteem, antisocial behavior, and really diminished social status. What role do they play in this problem, and how can they be better men? Because I do not believe that the problem is men against women. I believe the problem is today and always has been power against men and women, and using these artificial turf wars to distract people from what the real issues are. Plus, a generation of idiots, smartphones, and dumb people by a millennial. And it's not what you think by the title. It's very insightful. I think you'll find that of interest too. But we always start with the latest on health and healing. And first up, from the University of Cambridge in the Great Britain, a new study published today suggests how empathetic we are, not just as a result of our upbringing and experience, but also partly because of our genes. Now, empathy has two parts: the ability to recognize another person's thoughts and feelings, and the ability to respond with an appropriate emotion to someone else's thoughts and feelings. And the first part is called cognitive empathy, and the second part is called affective empathy. A team of scientists from the University of Cambridge developed the empathy quotient, or what is called EQ. It's a brief report measure of empathy, and they measure both parts of empathy. And what they're now saying, and this was published in Translational Psychiatry, and they looked at over 46,000 individuals, and they found that empathy is also hardwired, or it's not, because it's not hardwired. And this had this does not make a difference necessarily as far as sexual differences, but why would that be? And I believe it's because they didn't go deep enough. They did not look at what is known as a major science today, and we talk about it all the time, epigenetics. In fact, we were just reaching Bruce Lipton over the weekend in New Zealand to talk about this on an upcoming program. We could be impacted by seven generations backwards of both our grandparents and how they were encouraged or learned or trained themselves to deal with empathetic issues or not. So whatever your great-great-grandparents did, you have those genes hardwired. So that would be your first inclination, is to respond what is considered congenital or natural to you. But what if that's inappropriate? What if, quite simply, you're trying to do the right thing, but you've been desensitized at the gene level to have certain feelings, and we've never taken that into account? We always start with the idea that you're responsible for what you say and do and how you process insights and information, how you respond to others. That's not true, because that excludes epigenetics completely. An example, let's say that your parents, your father was dominant, your mother was supportive but submissive to his power, and she became a sponge for all of his frustration or angst. And it's not necessary that he abused her in any way, physically or emotionally. It's just that he didn't think, what would be the response if I came home from work each day and I don't like my work, or something at work, something's wrong in my life, and I use my wife as a sounding board? It's not as if she's an impartial, inanimate object. She's a vital, functioning human being. She's absorbing that energy, and then it encodes in her DNA. And therefore, she's looking at the next conversation as being a negative one and pleasantly surprised if it's not. But once people get into patterns of behavior, they generally don't change those patterns for the rest of their life, unless they're forced to, like stopping smoking because you've had lung cancer, emphysema. So here's how it works. If you want to know, how am I going to respond to other people's dilemmas and problems? Will I look away? Will I say, it's not my business? Well, I say, those people, you know, it's too bad they're living in the wrong place and they got wiped out in Puerto Rico or in Bangladesh or in India, wherever it happened, or in Florida. They're thinking, not my problem. I got my own issues. Or they're the kind of person that says, gee, you know, maybe I can do something. What can I do? And so a person will go out of their way to try to find some way to help other people because they know those people need help. They don't want your compassion. Compassion doesn't do diddly squat. Empathy does. Empathy is not only understanding what a person is saying and how they're feeling, but then trying to infuse some support at a level that can actually make a difference. And if you find that that does not come easy, then there's a high probability that your genes are hardwired epigenetically to respond in ways that defer that to someone else. Not my job, I'm not the authority, I can't change anything. In which case, how can you deal with that? Regressive hypnosis. I mentioned in on the air the two very good people, outstanding people actually, Manette Loudon and Dr. Michael Ellner passed in the last 2 weeks. Michael was not the first. Dr. Donald Mullen, a really close friend of mine who was one of the top people for the Albert Ellis Center. Albert Ellis was very prominent psychotherapist and ran the center over on the east side, used hypnotherapy. Dr. Elaine Kahn used it. Dr. Alan Putterman used it. Dr. Martin Shepard, Lloyd Glauberman. They all came from different psychological backgrounds, but they all used hypnotherapy, and they had some really remarkable results. But we didn't know about epigenetics back then. We thought everything came from what you learn from birth till the age of 9. Whatever traits you had, whatever beliefs you had, you kept those the rest of your life. Those were almost impossible to change. It was Michael who was working with people with AIDS in my office. I remember when he first came. I knew Michael for 40 years. And he said that he was working with people before AIDS, before the AIDS crisis in the mid-1970s, when they were suffering from a bowel conditions. And he said, could I use your space when your office closed tonight? And I said, sure. And this was when I was on first downtown and then on Franklin Street, then up on 92nd and 2nd, and then Brownstone ahead in 84th. And there was one floor where I had two rooms, and I had about 15 chairs each room, so 30 people opened the door so both rooms, and Michael would stand between both rooms and talk with all these people. Almost all were gay, and they had problems. Well, I was working with gays at the same time who had been sent to me who were having problems that the doctor, Stephen Chiesa, a gay physician, could not heal. I was helping them heal all through lifestyle, also vitamin drips, homeopathy, detox, but at a much more substantial level than what the average person would do. And there I would see Michael putting people under hypnosis and going back and helping them resolve issues. And frequently those issues stem from their parents. And they would come out of it, and a week, 2, 3 weeks later, Michael saying, are you off this? Yeah, I'm not. I don't even have an urge for it. I didn't think I was under hypnosis, because when you're under hypnosis, you don't know you're under hypnosis. You know, you think I'm not asleep. I'm listening to everything he's saying. Yes, but you're also listening at the deeper subconscious level. So he was actually able to go in and help people change at the epigenetic level. No one else I'd ever met had done that. They all would help you at the conscious level. But he went deeper, and how he did it was he would get the person under hypnosis, then take them back to the earliest memories, and he would say, now you have a book in front of you and a coloring book, and there's either pretty pictures or ugly pictures, ones that make you smile or ones that make you sad. Which ones do you have? And then by working on these, he would find out these early traumas even before the child had an intellect to figure things out. When you cannot intellectualize, you emotionalize. So then he would bring him forward and then change the scenario. And there was one specific case where I had a friend, Dr. Morton Jacobs, wonderful human being, and he was known as the doctor with the healing hands. He did a lot of hands-on work. And I was waiting to have lunch with him, and I was waiting in his office when he came out. There was this guy, and he said, well, I'll see you next month. And Marty said, all right. And something occurred to me. I said, why would you see him next month? He said, well, I've been seeing him every month for the last 3 years. What for? I have every month, like clockwork, I have on the 28th, my back, upper back, goes into spasm. My neck, my back, I'm so pained, can't handle it. And I said, that's a manifestation physically, but that's psychological. And he said, no. I said, well, and I said, Morty, what do you think? He said, I don't know. I mean, he's all cramped up. I have to do some deep tissue work. I said, would you be willing to try an experiment? Guy said, okay. So got the hypnosis, put him under, took him back, and here's what happened. I think it was around the age of 4. He was getting up from the dinner table and carrying dishes to the kitchen, and he tripped on the rug, and he broke some dishes, and his father yelled at him that he was irresponsible. You know, he couldn't do anything right. And so he went into a corner and just looked in the corner, and he tightened up his neck and put his head down, and he was, that trauma, that energy was locked in. So why would it be every 28 days? Because now he was a bank manager. And on the 28th, they would have their district meeting, and each bank manager would go over with their supervisors what was happening in their bank. And even though it was, you know, a normal meeting, subconsciously he would perceive an authority figure possibly reprimanding him for not being responsible, in this case, as a responsible manager. So he would go through this physiological trauma as if it were real. Well, the physical manifestation is real, but not its cause. So then the hypnotherapist changed this story, went back and said, now, we're going to get up from the table, get all these plates, and your father's going to say, do you know in Greece when they've had a great meal and they're celebrating a marriage or birth of a child, they throw those dinner plates into the fireplace and break them. So let's just throw them over there. And the boy goes over and he's throwing the dishes in the fireplace. And then the father goes over and gives him a big hug and says, no matter what you do in your life, I'll never stop loving you. You're very responsible. Brought him out of hypnosis. He never came back again because he told Marty, the pain is not there. So when people tell you you can't change epigenetics, yes, you can. I've seen thousands of people change underlying long-term conscious or subconscious conditioned response in their bodies. Happens, but you have to know what you're doing. Michael Elner was one of those people who did it. That just came to mind. Anyhow, from Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, they found that intravenous arginine, ARG, A-R-G, anine, which means amino acid, I-N-I-N-E, N-I-N-E is always amino acid, benefits children after acute metabolic strokes. So just in lay language, children with mitochondrial diseases, that's a lot of people who have had vaccine damage and autism especially, who suffered acute metabolic strokes, benefit from rapid intravenous treatment with the amino acid arginine, no side effects from the treatment. Now, the diseases were caused by a range of different genetic disorders. In half of the stroke episodes, patients showed clinical improvements in symptoms like seizures and partial paralysis. So that's terrific. And by the way, mitochondria, mito, M-I-T-O, chondria, C-H-O-N, excuse me, C-H-O-N-D-R-I-A-L, these results from malfunctionings of your energy-producing batteries dwelling within your cells. And so this was published in Molecular Genetics and Metabolism. So intravenous, this was done at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. And they looked at 8 years of clinical experience providing intravenous arginine when new onset neurologic problems concerning acute stroke like episodes developed in pediatric mitochondrial disease patients. Something new, something people did not know about, and it's working, natural and non-toxic. From the Benson Henry Institute for Mind-Body Medicine, they're showing how meditation can reduce inflammation and alter gene expression. We have all many times in our life felt the fight or flight response, that automatic, unpleasant chemical reaction in the body triggered by stressful situations. And this frequently felt in our gut, sick to my stomach, what people frequently think. these chemical reactions have a negative influence on our genes and health. But then the question arises, can meditation or prayer or yoga give us the opposite effect? The answer is yes. The research is showing that repetitive yoga poses, prayer, and mantras can actually help reduce inflammation and the stress-induced gene expression that can lead to chronic disease. And while the fight-or-flight response is valuable when the body is in imminent physical danger, it can severely tax the body. It only lasts about a minute, minute and a half, and you can trigger a fight-or-flight response just with a negative thought, just with a stressful thought. So if you're suffering with any form of chronic health condition, the opposite of the fight-or-flight response is called the relaxation response, and it's extremely valuable. So why meditation is a powerful tool against stress? Meditation and yoga and other spiritually inspired practices can cause the opposite effect of stress. They reduce inflammation and promote positive, health-sustaining gene expression that supports good health. A Benson Henry Institute of Body Mind Research out of the Beth Israel Medical Center in Massachusetts General Hospital conducted research on this and found absolutely worked. The deep breathing, the repeated mantras, and that brought down blood pressure, brought down blood sugar, turned off the stress hormones, and allowed for healing. And finally, from the University of Cincinnati, published in the Journal of Nutritional Neuroscience, you can get an enhanced neurological activation with blueberries, especially if you have mild cognitive impairment. So, this was a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial performed on pre- and post-intervention function. So, very, very powerful. So, take blueberries every day if you have any form of neurological condition, it's not just limited to the beginning of Alzheimer's, which is a dementia. I'm Gary Knoll. We're 22 minutes into our program. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. I'd like to thank all the people from all over the world who tuned in for the three-hour webinar last night. I enjoyed sharing that with you, and as well as answering your questions. The feedback was very positive. We got very good response. So my next webinar will be in the middle of April. More on that upcoming. I will be dealing with how do we bring equality back into our societies, dealing with poverty around the world. I'll have a whole panel of experts on that. The press, giddy with its newfound sense of mission and purpose, you've seen it. Panels with four or five people at CNN or MSNBC, always the same people, relatively small grouping, and you know what they're going to say, you know how they're going to say it, and they're absolutely self-righteous and that what they're saying is true and that there should be no other argument. Well, according to Chris Hedges, that's not the way it should be. Because what are they doing? They're carrying forward some mission and purpose out of moral crusade against Donald Trump. The airwaves and the print have shed their traditional claims of impartiality and objectivity. They fulminate against Trump charging falsely that he was elected because of Russian interference, in calling him a liar and ignorant and incompetent. They give airtime to his bitterest critics and bizarre associates, such as that Omasara Newman, a one-time star of The Apprentice and now a fired White House aide, and Stormy Daniels, the porn actress who says she had a sexual relationship with Trump. It's great entertainment for the masses, I guess. It's really good for the ratings. It's great for profits. But it is not moral, and it's not journalism. The empty posturing is a mask of self-interest. It's accompanied by the veneration of the establishment politicians, the generals, the intelligence chiefs, the corporate heads, and hired apologists who carried out the corporate coup d'etat that created our system of inverted totalitarianism. The corporate structures that have a stranglehold on the country and have overseen deindustrialization and the evisceration of democratic institutions, plunging over half the country into chronic poverty and misery, are unassailable. They are portrayed as forces of progress. The criminals on Wall Street, including the heads of the financial firms like Goldman Sachs, are treated with reverence. Free trade is equated with freedom. Democratic politicians like Barack Obama, who assaulted civil liberties and transferred trillions of dollars of wealth upwards to reigning oligarchs, expanded the drone wars to include targeted assassinations of American citizens, and used the Espionage Act to silence investigative journalism, they're all held as champions of democracy. Deference is paid to democratic processes. Liberties, electoral politics, and rights enshrined in our Constitution, from due process to privacy, that no longer exist. It's a vast game of deception under the cover of a vacuous morality. Those cast aside by corporate capitalism, Noam Chomsky calls them unpeople, are rendered invisible and reviled at the same time. The so-called experts, whose opinions are amplified on every issue from economics to empire and politics, are drawn from corporate-funded think tanks, specifically the Heritage Foundation, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the American Enterprise Institute, or former military and intelligence officials or politicians who are responsible for the failure of our democracy, and usually in the employ of corporations. Cable news also has the habit of interviewing its own news celebrities. Former CIA Director John Brennan, one of the many former officials now on the airwaves, has morphed into a senior national security and intelligence analyst for NBC and MSNBC. Let us not forget that Brennan was the architect of the disastrous attempt to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to arm so-called moderate, the good terrorist rebels in Syria, and oversaw the huge expansion of our drone wars and instigated the canard that Russia stole the last U.S. presidential election. The most astute critics of empire, including Andrew Bosevich, are banished, as are critics of corporate power like Ralph Nader, even Noam Chomsky. Those who decry the waste within the military, like MIT Professor Emeritus Ted Postol, who has exposed the useless $13 billion anti-ballistic missile program, are unheard. Advocates of universal health care, what we promote constantly on this program and have for decades, like Dr. Margaret Flowers, they're locked out of the national health care debates. There's a long list of the censored. The acceptable range of opinion is so narrow, it's simply non-existent. Where is the flood of stories about families being evicted or losing their homes because of foreclosures and bank repossessions? Where are the stories about the banks and the lending agencies that prey on recent college graduates burdened with crippling loans and unable to find work? Where are the stories about families going into bankruptcy because they cannot pay medical bills and the soaring premiums for-profit health care? And where are the stories about the despair that drives middle-aged white men to suicide and millions of Americans into the deadly embrace of opiate addiction? And where are the stories on the cruelty of mass incarceration, the collapse of our court system, and the reign of terror by the police in marginal communities? And where are the investigative pieces on the fraud and the tax boycott that have been legalized by Wall Street and for Wall Street? What about the poisoning of our ecosystems by the fossil fuel and animal agricultural industries? Why is climate change a forbidden subject, even as extreme weather devastates the nation and much of the rest of the planet? And why are the atrocities we commit or abet in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Yemen ignored? Why are the war crimes carried out by Israel against Palestinians erased from news coverage? Where are the stories on the truth about the dangers of vaccines, the real dangers of nuclear energy, why we don't need to waste $1 trillion on new nuclear programs? Has anyone actually gone into the inner city and spent quality time there to spend a week with the people to see what it's like waking up each day when you were at one time in your life gainfully employed, had a family, could pay your bills, had no debt, and today you're living in destitute conditions? Where's the coverage? The relentless pillaring of Trump is news as reality television. Trump fills in for Richard Hatch of the old Survivor show. Trump's imbecility, his dishonesty, his narcissism, and his incompetence are at once revolting and riveting. The press, ostensibly seeking a more polished brand to improve the public presentation of empire and corporate capitalism, is in fact further empowering the lunatics who will dominate the political landscape. The stunts pulled during the last presidential election, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul wearing goggles as he chainsawed the tax code in half, Trump inviting women who accused Bill Clinton of sexual assault to a presidential debate, and Ben Carson having to defend himself against allegations he lied when he wrote that as a child he attempted to stab another boy, will become staples of political campaigning. Voters stripped of all meaningful power or control over their own destiny, used only as stage props in rallies and at party conventions, are permitted to vote only for a system that everyone hates. And the winners are those who can give the best and most entertaining expression of that hatred. Trump found the flaw in the American Death Star. That was from Matt Tabibi. It doesn't know how to turn the cameras off, even when it's filming its own demise. If the press sided with citizens and exposed the corporate systems of power that hold them captive, its advertising income would dwindle, and it would be treated as an enemy of the state. And since corporations own the airwaves and declining city newspapers, all, this will not happen. Journalism will remain burlesque. The public broadcasting system, PBS, along with NPR, National Public Radio, dependent upon corporate money, including the Koch brothers, is as loath to take on the corporate establishment as its for-profit competitors. The censors and critics exist only on the margins of the Internet, and the abolition of net neutrality will see them silenced as well. It is my personal opinion that within the next year to two, 90% of opinion pieces, articles, editorials, investigative reports, podcasts that challenge corporate America or the government will be censored. They've already done this to Mike Adams and took off, I think, 7,000 articles. And his YouTube's screenings. Why? What did they fear? CNN's Jack Taper, one of the high priests in the Trump Inquisition, was quite open about the narrowness of the assault. Being interviewed on the Axe Files podcast hosted by former Obama White House aide David Rexroth, he addressed the charges that he opposes Trump's policy by saying, "Whenever anybody says to me, I say you can't find any evidence about what I think about his tax plan or repealing Obamacare. Might be true, but here's the point. When we no longer have faith in our media of being honest and objective, then we are in big trouble. Now we're going to go right over and play a clip, an audio clip, and this is from Emma Watson and The Future of Feminism, narrated by The Factual Feminist. Please listen.
Is the belief that men and women should have equal rights and opportunities. It is the theory of the political, economic, and social equality of the sexes.
Now, she correctly notes that today many reject the feminist label. And in fact, according to a 2014 poll, only about 25% of Americans call themselves feminists. Now, Ms. Watson suggests that feminism has lost popularity because many associate it with an aggressive, isolating, male-hating philosophy.
The more I've spoken about feminism, the more I have realized that fighting for women's rights has too often become synonymous with man-hating.
Now, she may have been suggesting that the stereotype about male-hating is baseless, but Ms. Watson just graduated from Brown University, and it cannot have escaped her that some of the excesses of today's campus feminism, with its penchant for trigger warnings and grievance collecting and demonizing men, even statues of men, she must have noticed all of this. I mean, just look at these gender activists, how they behaved at a University of Toronto event where the writer Warren Farrell was invited to speak about men's health.
You are scum. Rape apologist, incest supporting, woman hating scum.
And not to play the victim, just look at what the Tumblr feminists did to my book on the plight of boys and young men. They burned my book. Feminism is supposed to be about liberation, freedom, self-determination, not calling perfectly nice men rape apologist scum, or burning books, or treating masculinity as a pathology in need of a cure. Now, just to be clear, I did cringe several times during her speech, especially when she lamented the alleged injustice of being called bossy when she was a little girl. And I was sorry to hear her recite a version of the massively discredited gender wage gap. But I forgive her the cliches and talking points, because she did a good job focusing on the genuine plight of women living in societies that have not had the benefit of two major waves of female liberation. She made it clear that as a young woman growing up in Britain, she enjoyed the benefits of a mostly gender-fair society. So it was great that she gave attention to the 15.5 million girls who will be married as children, and girls in Africa who were denied the same education as boys. An American women's movement, a British women's movement that focused on helping girls and women across the globe with their struggle for emancipation, that would have wide appeal. And I suspect that Emma Watson could lead the movement in that direction. But here's what I really liked about the speech. She showed the way to a new kind of gender equity movement. Call it equalism rather than feminism.
Men, I would like to take this opportunity to extend your formal invitation.
She noted the ways in which men's needs are neglected, such as the high rate of male suicide. She acknowledged the importance of fathers. Now, Watson didn't mention it, but in both Britain and the U.S., men are falling behind in education. They're more likely than women to be injured or killed on the job or to be victims of violent crime. And they tend to die several years earlier than women. Now, in the world's advanced democracy, it's just hard to say which sex is doing better because it's a complicated mix of burdens and benefits. So a modern gender equity movement that would seek to help both sexes with their distinctive problems, that could be so successful. So to answer my original question, was Emma Watson's UN speech a game changer for feminism? Yes, it well might be, especially if she and her fellow millennials take it in the humane direction hinted at in her speech. Ms. Watson reminded us that feminism is about human flourishing. She reminded us that men and women are in this together. We complement and need each other. We're friends, not adversaries. Maybe instead of masculinism or feminism, it's time for equalism. Well, what did you think of Emma Watson's speech?
No, that's one perspective. We can agree or disagree. But I think it's important that we hear what a young millennial who is not out hating all men or believing that masculinity is the disease and it should be changed. All men should be somehow made different. But rather we should look at how to help both men and women with the unique problems they both suffer from, whether it's domestic violence or inequality or unfair working conditions or some form of wage discrimination. All of these are legitimate concerns. All of them must be addressed. But isn't it time that we got over the idea that the only problem is men? Now, the other night, I don't have it ready for today. I will for tomorrow, because I consider it one of the most dangerous talks I've ever heard in the history of television on Friday night on Tucker Carlson. I'll play you the clip tomorrow. And it shows you at what stage the most rabid of these men haters are at, what they want to do next. You won't believe it, but it's gaining popularity. I'll say no more than that, but it ties in with artificial intelligence and some other issues I've been telling you are here now and what is possible. And if it's possible, it's going to happen. I just wouldn't want that to happen. So let us now go over and hear someone who's trying to help men in this case. He also deals with women's issues. Professor Jordan Peterson. You never hear him in the United States. On the web, yes, because the left does not like his mindset on some issues. Now, I can take issue and would on some things he says, but listen to the things he said that are reasonable and responsible and give us a more clear picture at a deeper level. This man is not a shallow thinker. This is Professor Jordan Peterson talking about beta males, low social status, antisocial behavior.
He's got a big Oedipal problem, old Rob Crum. And the problem with him, fundamentally, is his mother was something like a giant spider and did everything she possibly could to crush the life out of him, hence his remaining relationship with women. And so that's part of the reason why femininity can be something that turns you to stone. It's an experience that many men are familiar with, by the way, because the average man is rejected far more often than he's accepted. And since women are the gateway to reproduction, they constitute nature itself. And nature itself tells most men, you should go home and stay under your bed. There's lots of experiments done about this. So, for example, psychologists will have an undergraduate woman go out into the concourse and see how long it takes her to find someone who agrees to sleep with her. And that takes, 2 seconds after she asks the first man. And then they flip it, and they get your random undergraduate guy to do the same thing. It's, well, you can imagine the consequences of that, since many of you men have lived through it. Mother Nature, the woman wears the face of Mother Nature, and the face is generally rejecting, especially to men who are low in the dominance hierarchy, by the way, which is one of the things that irritates guys like Elliot Rodgers, and one of the things that motivates their desire to take revenge. And that's a universal phenomena. So that's part of the reason that the feminine is nature, and why nature, by the way, is Mother Nature. It's like its diagnosis of your status is not good enough. The higher you are in the dominance hierarchy, the more resources you have at your disposal, and so the less upset you have to get when anything horrible happens. So if you're barely clinging to the bottom of the social structure, you can be sure that your brain is going to estimate any anomalous occurrence as a catastrophe, which is why people don't like being at the bottom of the dominance hierarchy, and it's also why people who are there die a lot sooner. And they die a lot sooner regardless of their absolute level of wealth. It's relative deprivation that counts. One of the things that your brain is very concerned with is relative status. That's wired in, by the way, which is partly why relative poverty is often such a social problem. People hate being low in status, especially men. Well, the male status hierarchy is a bit different than women, and women are pretty sensitive to status too, but they use different markers. Anyways, part of what happens when your status goes up is that your brain serotonin levels go up, and when your brain serotonin levels go up, you're less irritable and you experience less negative emotion per unit of uncertainty or threat. And so when you demean someone and you interfere with and you lower their presumed status as far as a very primordial circuit is concerned, you alter the system that regulates their emotions. And they hate that. People hate that more than anything. And it's an unbelievably archaic circuit. You can kind of tell this because depressed people basically act like they're low status. And depressed people are depressed about everything. Now, it's not easy to be depressed about everything, right? And so the fact that that's the case means that what's ever gone astray has to be very primordial because it affects everything. Anyways, people often use antidepressants to cure depression, hence their name. And antidepressants decrease the rate at which serotonin is taken back up by the neurons that produce it. Well, 300 million years ago, crustaceans emerged. And crustaceans live in dominance hierarchies, even though they're not particularly social. And if one lobster fights with another and gets defeated, then he won't fight with another lobster, even when he beat for 20 minutes, unless you give him antidepressants, in which case he'll fight again right away. And the reason I'm telling you this is because the status structure that underlies your being, not just your brain, but your being, is so old you share it with crustaceans. So you mess with it at your peril. It's not learned, by no means. So anyways, you wander around inside one of these little frames, going from point A to point B all the time. And one of the annoying things about life, and this is sort of the Sisyphus story, is that as soon as you climb from point A to point B, and you get there, then there's another point A and another point B. And that's kind of interesting, too, because one of the things it suggests is that getting somewhere isn't really what people want, because as soon as you get somewhere, then you're done going there, and then you have to get somewhere else. So in some sense, it seems it's an accomplishment. In another sense, it's just the next rock up the mountain. Now, you all know this because, you know, you graduated from university, and that was a good day. But the next day, you weren't a university student. You were some unemployed loser. You know, and so, and that's a, you know, that sets up a whole new set of problems, right? And I mean, that's how the frame shifts. And when the frame shifts like that, then the value of everything shifts around it. So, it turns out that people are actually more interested in getting from point A to point B than they are in actually being at point B. And almost all of the positive emotion that you feel, which is related to dopaminergic circuitry, by the way, you experience in relationship to the pursuit of a valued goal rather than to the attainment of the goal. The attainment of the goal actually satisfies you, or more specifically, it satisfies that motivational circuit, but then the damn thing just shuts off and another one starts yelling at you. So it's like a perverse form of victory. So one answer to that that's universal in some sense is that you should establish a relationship with a transcendent value, because it never runs out of motivational power. And as soon as things fall apart, which they always do, you're in chaos, and as soon as you're in chaos, then your body defaults to emergency preparation, and you're stressed, and if you're stressed long enough, then you die. And so you don't like that. Stress, when your body gets stressed, what happens is, because it doesn't really know what's going on, it prepares for everything. That's the generalized stress response. Cortisol production does that. Cortisol production is good, it wakes you up in the morning, but if it's chronic, you get old. Like, it's so general in its negative actions that the best way to conceptualize its detrimental long-term effect is that it accelerates aging. So it makes you more likely to have heart disease and cancer and depression and Alzheimer's and diabetes and obesity. That'll do. It's enough. Any of those are enough to kill you. All right, so there's a hierarchy. That's a hierarchy of values. The higher the value, the less you want to have it disrupted. Now, there's a psychologist named Piaget. Some of you might know about him. Piaget was very interested in what happens to value structures and their hierarchical organization once they have to apply outside of the confines of a body. So here's a way of thinking about it. Two-year-olds basically hypothalamic. That's why they're so much fun. First they're happy, then they're sad, then they're hungry, then they're tired. You know, they just zip from one pretty straightforward and rather awe-inspiring motivational state to another. But at two, they can't play. They can play by themselves, But they can't play with other children. They can't get that until they're three. And they need to get it by the time they're three, because if they don't get it by the time they're four, they will never get it. And then you have an antisocial kid who's going to be an outsider for his entire life, and there isn't anything you can do about it. So that has to happen between two and four. So what happens at about age three is that the kid learns how to play a game with another person. And what that game is fundamentally the development of the ability to share a frame of reference, which is what you're doing when you play Monopoly. It's like, it's stupid to play Monopoly, obviously. Who cares if you have a whole pile of counterfeit paper, right? But it doesn't matter, eh? Because the way you're constituted is that your brain will treat anything you act like constitutes a valuable goal as if it's a valid framework of reference. And if it couldn't do that, A, you couldn't abstract, and B, you could not get along with other people. So you can sit around the table and you can say, let's pretend that Monopoly is a reasonable facsimile of reality, which you wouldn't say, but it's what you mean. And everybody says, yes, that would be amusing. And so then you set your goal, which is to get all the little hotels and all the money, and poof, your emotions go along for the ride. And what's so interesting about that is you can get everybody into the game. And so one of the things that's really interesting about people is that we can establish a shared fictional frame of reference, and it organizes all our emotions so they're predictable. That's also why we can watch movies. You go to a movie, you identify the hero. You figure out what the hero wants, poof, you're the hero. And the way that works is you don't look at the hero and think about what he's doing and evaluate it emotionally and then feel it. What you do is you specify the hero's goal and then you map him onto your body and you read off the emotional responses of your own body, and that's how you understand the hero. So it's embodied. You're using your embodiment as a computational device that can run simulations of other consciousnesses. We have these shared frames of reference, like when we're playing Monopoly. Okay, so children at three learn how to play games, and that means they learn how to organize their own internal motivational states into a hierarchy that includes the motivational states of other people. And that means they can play. And that's what you guys do when you're out in the world. Like, we're playing a game right now. We all know the rules. That's why we can all sit in this room and play the game without fighting with each other. You know, and the room is set up like a theater, and we all know the theater game. And so, and the chairs are always facing this way at the moment, and so that's a hint that you should look forward. And this is raised, so, you know, the room is basically telling you what to do, because it's a stage, like all rooms. And because you're smart and socially conscious, you can walk into a staged room, and your body knows what to do. And if you're civilized and social, you just do it, then all the other primates can predict what you're up to.
Running out of time, so I cut it there. We're going to have more of him on, because he is simply one of the brightest psychotherapists in the world. Some of his positions we agree with, some we can challenge, but we're needing to hear this. We're needing to hear, how does a young boy or a young girl, in this case boys, how do they end up antisocial? And just to abbreviate something that would have taken another 6 minutes to say, and we only have another three, that if you are encouraged to accept the unique differences of people and that look for your own uniqueness, then when you're rejected or you don't do something or you're not selected to play ball with the team, and I think any athlete listening right now will know how that feels if you weren't the one selected to play whatever it is, basketball, pickup game, and you're having to watch other people, that can affect your self-esteem, unless you're a person who was raised with the idea that it's just a game. It does not determine who you are. Get over it. If you win, let it go. If you lose, let it go. It's just something we do that hopefully strengthens us. And then there's the idea of looking for role models, women for women, men for men, and others for both, who exemplify what the parents hopefully have found to be good character references, people who are successful, but they're not narcissistic, they're not conceited, they don't feel better than you, they don't try to make themselves so special that they live through some artificial illusion. They're just real, genuine people, and you can look at them and say, wow, you know, I'd like to grow up to be like that person. But that person is not a fraud, they're not a phony, they're real. You know, that they're real people. Now, we've had these people in our society. We've had hundreds of thousands of them. And for men, frequently athletes, also today women as well. So you want someone that you can look to because it motivates you. Well, what happens if you have no heroes? What if the parents say, everyone's the same? You know, you're all winners. That's not realistic. And then the first time that the child is rejected, the first time the child is put down, the first time peers mock or ridicule something within the child's behavior, they're going to personalize it. And once they personalize it, there's one or two ways it can go. Antisocial behavior, where they hate everybody because someone has taken what little thread of self-respect they have and they've set it on fire. Frequently, those people will try to prove to others that they have value. They'll become lawyers and judges. They'll become successful. But that isn't because they want to become successful or they desire that. It's because they need to show, you said I wasn't a nobody. You didn't select me. Now look who I am. I can buy and sell you. That kind of mindset. Or it can go the opposite way, where someone doesn't want to try. There's no motivation. Why try? I'm not going to succeed. I can't change the world. No one's going to pay attention to me. Who am I? I'm a nobody. In which case, they live with depression. They generally don't take care of themselves. They end up with far more disease. They die younger life. And, or they become very nihilistic and hang out with other people who are very nihilistic. They see everything, as he said, they see everything as causing their malaise or depression or angst. They don't find any joy in anything. Irony of ironies, there are some radio and television programs that want to bring you in as their audience if you are one of these people living in that quandary of doubt about your own authenticity. These are the reality shows. Happy, positive people would never watch a reality show. We're out of time. Thank you all for watching, listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.
Today, I was happy as a lark, but now